Yesterday, a new food truck lot opened at the intersection of Varick and Grant Streets, not far from WNYC Studios. And it's just the latest development in a process that's making food trucks seem ubiquitous in New York. It may look easy, but there are lots of steps to creating a successful one. And lately, many of the mobile cuisine entrepreneurs have complained that city officials are making the process of opening and running a food truck far too complex. With us now to discuss all things food truck is David Weber, the co-owner of Rickshaw Dumplings. He's the founder and president of the New York Food Truck Association and author of a new book called The Food Truck Handbook, Start, Grow, and Succeed in the Mobile Food Business. It's published by Wiley. Also here are Deborah Smith of the Green Pirate, a food truck that specializes in juices and health food, and Jim Drew, co-owner of Phil's Steaks, an authentic cheese truck. Cheese steak truck, Philly, right? Phil's Steaks, we got it. You're usually at Union Square, right?
Every night at Union Square, and usually Financial District or Midtown for lunch.
Now, David, you say that food trucks allow owners to take risks that wouldn't be possible if they were operating brick-and-mortar restaurants, but don't most food trucks cut down on the risk by offering fairly conventional snack food-like things?
Well, I think that one of the really exciting things about food trucks is they take a little bit less capital to get started, and so there's more space there to take a risk. And I think it's no accident that the Koji truck, which came in L.A., innovated on this idea of Korean-Mexican fusion, which has really sweeped all across the nation. You see kimchi taco trucks in pretty much every city, and even Applebee's this day and age has kimchi tacos as well. And all of that came off of a food truck.
What led you to create Rickshaw Dumplings?
Well, the idea actually was formed by my business partner. We met at the NYU Stern School of Business, and my business partner, Kenny Lowe, he's Chinese-American, and he grew up wrapping dumplings. It was a great family tradition for him. He always loved dumplings and was looking to make a business out of it. And so that's where Rickshaw was born.
Deborah, I read that your signature item, the Green Pirate, was inspired by a customer.
That's true. Yep. We had somebody come up to the truck and ask us, can I just have everything green on the truck but make it taste good? So we added in a couple of other ingredients, and there it was.
Did that wind up being your best-selling item?
It wound up being a really healthy, rich green juice that also tastes delicious. And so it is a bestseller, yeah. It's pretty popular.
Why do you think there aren't more people out there serving healthy food?
Well, particularly juice is challenging in that the fresh produce that we're working with every single day is perishable. So you either have to juice it or after a couple of days you kind of lose it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a ton of volume in, right? Tons of heavy cases of fresh produce. It's a ton of prep work to get it to be ready to juice. And then it's a ton of compost waste, organic waste matter out. So there's a lot of physical labor that goes into the start and the end of the day that is a real lifestyle choice that you make.
Now, Jim, I've heard that you opened your truck because you felt that there weren't any places here that offered authentic Philly cheesesteaks.
Yeah.
It's a fairly simple concept. Why do you think no one seemed capable of duplicating what you can get in so many different places in Philadelphia?
You know, I wasn't really sure about that at first, and there are a few good cheesesteak places in New York. There wasn't a food truck dedicated to cheesesteaks, and there certainly is a lack of cheesesteaks when you look at how many, Japanese restaurants are, you know, per block relative to how close Philly is and how few cheesesteaks are. So I think it was just a really open niche and, you know, really was there to exploit. So we really just jumped into it.
Well, isn't the key to authenticity using Cheese Whiz?
That is one of the keys. Ingredients are
I'm not going to ask key. Deborah whether she thinks that's the good idea. Yeah.
Cheese Whiz is the standard. Most people are most familiar with Pat's and Gino's, which are real famous for their Cheese Whiz. You know, I think there's some aficionados that really like provolone, so we also offer provolone, and we do American as well because it's just a good cheese, and it's good on cheesesteaks.
So why did you decide that a truck and not a storefront was the best place to sell cheesesteaks?
Well, David brought up a good point, and it's really the capital that it takes to start a food truck is less than to start a restaurant. The overhead's lower. You also have more of an opportunity to take risks, and you really can start something that you may not have. You just might not have the funding for it, and you might not have, you want to get into a locked-in for a 10 or 15-year lease or something like that.
I'm informed that bread from Philadelphia is different from the bread you get in New York, and you actually go to Philadelphia to get your bread?
No, we have it sent up here, but it's all about the water that's used in Philly to make the bread. And we use Amoroso's bread, which is pretty much one of the most known rolls down there. And, you know, cheesesteak's a pretty simple thing, but if you don't have really good ingredients for those few key things, it's just not the same.
And you're new to the food truck business.
Yeah, I'm definitely.
How has business been since you opened in January?
It's been great. We've really, I think we really tapped into something here. I mean, there's, you know, our biggest thing was to really click with all the Philly people that live in New York, because there's so many of them, and including myself. And and I feel like everyone I talk to always complains about not having enough cheesesteaks here. So it was kind of a no-brainer. I mean, we got out there and we really, like, just worked hard to get all our Philly friends and people we knew to come by and co-sign the truck, and it kind of worked like that.
Now, Debbie, you're something of a food truck veteran, but I've heard that you're thinking of getting out of the mobile food business soon because you've already expanded into other kinds of businesses?
Yeah, about a year ago, we were asked by a small market in Brooklyn to bottle and deliver juice, and that has been slowly growing. And there are variables to delivering or providing a service such as catering that are fixed, that don't rely on the weather, that don't rely on some of the really crazy variables that you go out and take a risk every day. Okay, I'm going out with a truck full of fresh produce, hoping that some healthy-minded New Yorker, I mean, again, we've been on the road now for 6 years, which I'm very proud of, and so we've built a great following and a good client base, but there's still these wild card variables such as the rain.
So you invest a lot of money in produce, and then it rains and people don't want to stop and wait for you to produce something.
Yeah, I remember some sad days where I was committed and dedicated to the street life and out there, and it was raining and thinking, I think there was a June of 2008, it rained, I think 26 out of the 30 days or something, and you know, we were sad that month. But there's been a real upswing in the trend of juice, so I'm looking for opportunities to stabilize it. Although I'm still dedicated to my truck, and I'm grateful to be on the street. So
I throw this out to all of you. Many New Yorkers don't patronize food trucks because they say the prices are too high. Why can't you sell at lower prices? Your dumplings, for example, David, are probably a little more expensive than I would pay in Chinatown.
Absolutely. So one of the things that for rickshaw specifically, looking at Chinatown dumplings versus rickshaw dumplings, there's a bunch of differences in terms of the cost structure as it pertains to the ingredients that we're using. So at rickshaw, we use all natural ingredients, Bell and Evans chicken, antibiotic-free pork, organic edamame. And so higher quality ingredients have a higher cost associated
with
them.
No cheese whiz?
No cheese whiz in the dumplings. No dairy at all. The other thing is rickshaw, the brick-and-mortar locations are in more mainstream locations than Chinatown, so the rent's a little bit higher, so that gets incorporated into the price. And, you know, when you move from a food truck or from a brick-and-mortar restaurant into a food truck, there are some cost savings in rent, but there's a host of other costs that end up taking up that part of the profit and loss. So there's a lot of tickets, there's a lot of fuel costs, there's a commissary where a Department of Health approved commissary where you have to park at night. So you end up, rather than paying rent, you're paying a bunch of other costs.
Yeah, it's a little, there definitely are more expensive involved to running a food truck than just having a truck and just being on the road.
So when restaurateurs complain that they have to pay rent and electric bills and gas and all of that, and that they're also losing customers to a food truck that's parked down the street, they're not realizing that you are not all that different than somebody who opened up a restaurant down the block?
Well, I would say the overhead of a restaurant would be higher, but you know, you can't underestimate the overhead of a truck either. There are also a lot of advantages to having a restaurant. For one thing, you don't have to deal with not getting a parking space that day.
Cops
moving you along, people complaining, the weather could be bad. I mean, there's so many variables that go into a food truck business that you can't just go out every day and expect to have the type of day that a restaurant has. It's just not realistic.
And David, in your book, you say that food trucks promote a sense of community more than a restaurant?
No, not more than a restaurant, but in a different way than a restaurant, I think. One of the really interesting things that you can do with food trucks is you can activate public space in a way that you couldn't otherwise. One of the really successful events that we've done through the Food Truck Association has been the Prospect Park Food Truck Rallies. And we do these the third Sunday of every month. And ordinarily at Grand Army Plaza, nothing really happens on it's underused. On Saturdays, there's a green market, and it's great. And excuse me, the entire community comes out. And then on Sunday, to have 16 trucks there, it's just it brings all these people out, and people that wouldn't normally be interacting or next to each other in line. How is the lobster roll? How is the juice? How is the sandwich? And it gets people talking because one thing that everyone has an opinion about and everyone has a passion about is food.
And then there's a flea market, Smorgasburg, in Williamsburg, where there are a lot of food trucks. But what's your reaction, I throw this out to all of you, to Burger King's decision to put food trucks on some city streets to promote new menu items?
I did not know that.
I didn't either.
I think it's,
you know, reverse competition.
Exactly. Yeah. As you know, the food truck trend has grown. I think the food truck trend has been driven by a couple things, including a little bit less capital to get started, the social media infrastructure, the Facebook, the Twitter, that allows people to track food trucks over space and time, and these focus menus where you're getting really great best-in-breed food, like the best juices in the city from Green Pirate or the best cheesesteak. You're getting these sort of experts at food. But what you're also getting is like entrepreneurs doing exciting things and the ability for people to support an entrepreneur. And I think that that's something that big companies need to keep in mind as they move sort of from the reverse, from an established brand into this space, is to bring something new and innovative and exciting to it.
Yeah, and I mean, I look at it as like the food trucks are kind of just like a blank canvas that entrepreneurs can really use and, you know, give them an opportunity to create a brand that most people, you know, that you can start for maybe a fifth of the price that you could at a restaurant.
Last year, Gothamist reported on a feud between Oasis, a falafel restaurant in Williamsburg, and a Time Mobile, a truck that also specialized in Middle Eastern food, was parking the restaurant fell too close. Are feuds like that common? Wouldn't the food truck have been cleverer to just park in another area where there weren't Middle Eastern restaurants?
I can't comment directly on this case because I don't know the details of it, but I would say that one of the things that we advocate specifically is community-oriented vending. Going out, making sure you know the neighborhood really well where you're going to vend, not to be abrasive and inflammatory and vend close to someone else that's selling similar food.
My guests are David Weber, who is the author of the Food Truck Handbook, Start, Grow, and Succeed in the Mobile Food Business. It's published by Wiley. Also here are two other food truck operators, Jim Drew and Deborah Smith. Jen from the Upper West Side has called in to say that her neighbors prepare food for their carts. We're talking about carts in this case, I assume, in their apartment. Is that legal?
No.
So where do you prepare your stuff?
It needs to be prepared in a commissary that is city certified, and it has to have sanitation, has to have electricity. There's a bunch of other things that it has to have. I'm pretty sure that's illegal.
Everything needs to come from a Department of Health approved commissary facility.
So the same sort of thing that a restaurant would
absolutely
have to
yeah.
do, you have to do. Do you get little A's or grade pendings?
Unfortunately, at this point, there aren't letter grades for mobile food vendors. In L.A., where the entire letter grade system sort of came from, they did start with restaurants and then eventually did expand it to mobile food. And it's something that we would really like to see, because we'd like to see our vendors who are running really clean operations get credit for the good work that they're doing.
So let's talk about finding a spot, because mm-hmm. that's probably the most important thing. You've got to be in the right mm-hmm. neighborhood, in the right spot. And that sounds, judging from what you say in your book, a lot more difficult than I might have imagined. You just can't find a nice little parking spot and pull up and open for business. Are there spots that are reserved? For example, your Philly steak is always or near the Union Market, isn't it?
Union Square.
I meant Union
technically,
Square.
I believe there's no places that a food truck can really sell food from. And there's a big case that Patty's Taco versus the city. I forget exactly the name of it, but basically it was about vending from metered spaces. And that's sort of been a rule. Obviously, most spaces are metered in the city, and you'd have to park at one of them to vend. And by making that a rule that you can't sell food there, and they basically said that food would be merchandise in that situation, it really adds a problem. And normally, it's something that isn't enforced, because most people like the food trucks and they want them there. But, there'll be restaurants that'll complain and, you know, then you get you'll get inspected, or you'll get, you know, harassed, or you'll ask to leave and things like that.
David, you often park in front of the Trader Joe's on Atlantic and Court in Brooklyn. Now, there's not a restaurant there, but do they like the idea that you're there?
Yeah, you know, the manager of that location likes having the food truck there as an amenity to the guests. I think that one of the most important things, again, is this idea of community-oriented vending is really hitting the streets. People shouldn't be looking for places to vend in their truck in the hopes of pulling over, but really doing research ahead of time, hitting the streets on your bike, walking the streets, talking to the ground floor establishments, the retail establishments, seeing sort of what the neighborhood is like, finding a place where it's sunny, there's a lot of foot traffic, there might be a subway nearby or a movie theater, something to drive business, and also, you know, as legal as possible and as unencumbering for the local community as possible.
And Deborah, you're nodding your head. I'm assuming you try to find a place in a neighborhood where people are health conscious.
Yeah, actually, we took a slightly different approach. All last year, we parked kind of off the beaten path in Soho, which is a neighborhood where people really identify as health conscious. There's a lot of designers and a lot of fashion-based businesses there. So we chose that neighborhood because we knew we would do well. But as a result of doing the research and hitting the streets and talking to store owners and seeing where other trucks were being kicked out of and really looking and seeing what was happening, we wound up moving 2 to 3 streets sort of deeper into the neighborhood, really off the beaten path. And then we just flyered the neighborhood, let everybody know we're here. We weren't at a, quote, legal parking spot, but we talked to everyone in the neighborhood, including the local precinct. We're manning the truck at all times. We're able to move if necessary. The businesses nearby buy our juice and love the truck. We made friends with everyone surrounding the spot to make it safe. And then we were able to stay consistently there.
Now, you can't park in front of at a metered spot. That's
right.
A law?
Yeah, so this is one of the big challenges
that
we're facing.
If you were just putting quarters into the meter, wouldn't that be okay?
Yeah, well, if you're going to simply park your food truck, that's fine. The problem comes in when you're trying to sell. So there's what happened last year as more food trucks were hitting the street and it became certain neighborhoods were overcrowded with food trucks, someone dug up this law from 1965. And I'm just going to read it really quickly because I think the language in it is amazing. No peddler, vendor, hawker, or huckster shall park a vehicle at a meter parking space
those
for
hucksters.
The purposes of displaying, selling, storing, or offering merchandise for sale. And so for us...
But you run a three-card Monty food truck, don't you? Hucksters?
Yep, hucksters, hawkers.
We're going to be the definitely hucksters.
Yeah, the New York City Huckster Association. We're trying to vend in the best way possible for the community to provide an amenity. And I think there's a bunch of things that food trucks bring to the table, including, the amenity, the option to get more types of food here in New York City, the tax revenue that the city gets through sales tax, job growth, tourism, activating public space. And the last but not least is this idea of the food trucks as a hospitality incubator, growing from a food truck into a restaurant. This sort of definition of street food as somehow being merchandise and therefore being illegal to happen at meter parking is very, very onerous for the trucks because almost every commercial district is completely metered.
Susan Povich, the owner of the Red Hook Lobster Pound food truck and one of Brooklyn's top 10 entrepreneurs, according to Inc. magazine, has said that unless legislation is made more food truck friendly, the market's going to lose the core people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So New York is particularly hard on food trucks? How do we compare to other cities?
Absolutely. This is one of the hardest places to get started and one of the hardest places to operate across the country. One of the sort of few national brands of food trucks is the Cool House ice cream truck. And they do ice cream sandwiches, all these exciting flavors of ice cream and cookies. And so they operate in L.A., in Miami, and here in New York, in Austin, Texas. And they say above and beyond, you know, here's the hardest place to operate. But what makes New York so exciting is there's so many discriminating foodies. And there's so many people. Like, the urban density here is just unparalleled anywhere else in the world. So it's a very tempting market. And I think with the right regulatory structure, it could be just a phenomenal place for food trucks. And unfortunately, I have to say, I think we're losing out a little bit to L.A. Because the regulations here are so hard. Since 2008, you've really seen food trucks blossom in L.A., and here it's growing very slow relative to there. And the Koji truck, which is the iconic food truck that everyone's always talking about, actually tried to open here in 2008 and wasn't able to make it work because of the permitting and the licensing issues.
Deborah, you've been reaching out to food truck fans with a campaign called Save the Food Trucks, and that's in response to a ban in Midtown. It's harder to park a food truck in Midtown because of the parking meters, or just because there is hostility to food trucks there? What happens when a cop sees you?
Yeah, I was a part of that campaign, and I still am helping to promote it. To the best of my understanding, there were just giant chunks of the neighborhood in Midtown shut down for mobile food vendors, and lots of longtime vendors whose, you know, sort of bread and butter was established at those spots in the neighborhood lost their businesses or were forced to move, which caused overcrowding in some of these other popular spots, including right down here in this neighborhood.
Well, we have some food trucks down here, but I suspect some of them are breaking the law because every place is metered here.
Yeah. The metered is really the core of the Midtown ban. There is no specific Midtown ban. It's just that because Midtown is so dense and such a tempting place to vend, that's where so many food trucks end up going, and that's where you see more enforcement because there's more trucks there. The core rule is really always coming back to the no vending for metered parking.
Now, a couple of listeners have written in with criticisms. Paul from Harlem posted this comment. According to the EPA, it's against the law for any vehicle to idle longer than 30 seconds. Are food trucks in violation of that law? And Kurt on Twitter says, please address the noise and gasoline fumes issue with food trucks around Union Square. Forgive us for saying that. It is a nuisance factor.
Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. I would have to respectfully disagree with both those comments, obviously. But for one thing, they're not technically idling because the engine's not on. So the engine is off when you're vending food.
You're running something else to keep your stove going.
Yes,
refrigerator.
There's a generator that is keeping all the electricity on. The engine is definitely not on.
Yeah.
Some of them are a little loud. Others less
so. There's a big spectrum in the types of generators that are on board the trucks. And so you see some of the Mr. Softies have very, very big generators on the back to power the soft serve ice cream machines. I think what you see in a lot of the branded differentiated food trucks where people are extremely conscientious of the entire experience, people are investing in high performance soundproof generators that have low emissions and low noise pollution. And this is something that we're open to having as part of the regulatory structure of food trucks as some sort of decibel constraints on the generator of noise.
Now, who enforces the laws relating to food trucks? Meter attendants, Department of Health employees, Parks and Recreation Department employees? Because in an interview on FastCompany.com, Natasha Case of Cool House said that the police try to shut her operation in Central Park down once a week.
That's very possible.
Is Central Park the wrong place to be?
That particular operation, she actually had a permit through the Parks Department. So here in New York City, there's 3,000 citywide mobile food vending licenses that are street vending licenses. And then the parks have control over concessions within the park. Her particular concession was in a park, and there was just confusion about the permit. I think one of the problems is the rules are extremely convoluted and antiquated. The great thing about New York City is we have this very rich history of street vending back to, you know, hawking oysters on Pearl Street, but an extremely convoluted legislative and regulatory structure so that no one really knows the rules. It's taken me 2 years to sort of digest like a summary of it. A lot of the NYPD aren't fully informed of it. A lot of the operators don't know all the rules. So I think that's one of the first steps is to categorize everything, come up with a more concise set of rules, and broadly disseminate it so everyone knows what they are.
So when we're quoting rules from 1965 about, what was that word? I never heard, hawking?
Or hucksters.
Hucksters? I'm going to use that from now on.
Well, but this is obviously an extension of tradition in New York that go all the way back to push carts, saying, and earlier. How difficult is it to get a license and a permit?
There's a lot of barriers to entry here in New York City. Because there's a cap on the number of permits, it's hard for new entrants to get into the space. And the other problem is licenses. Every food vendor needs a permit to operate for their vehicle, and every employee on it needs a license. The licenses are extremely challenging for our constituents because it takes 6 to 8 weeks to get a new license for your employees. Every single individual on the truck needs one, And part of that license requirement is a sales tax certificate of authority, which is completely the opposite of the way a restaurant would work, where there's one certificate on the wall. On a food truck, every individual needs their own personal sales tax certificate of authority. And if you've ever gone to New York State and tried to get this as a human, it's very hard. The entire structure is designed for a corporation to get a sales tax certificate.
You've talked me out of opening my food truck.
Oh, really? What was your idea?
I can't reveal it. Somebody will steal it. Can you take us through a typical day to the time that you're actually selling food during the lunch hours? Begin with you, Deborah.
Okay, yeah. Well, for us, we typically receive deliveries very early in the morning, and we're getting cases of fresh produce. We receive them at our commissary depot. And so a staff member is there to receive the order, make sure that everything is on the list, and then begin prepping in the commercial kitchen space, which is a lot of washing, rinsing, cutting, peeling, prepping. It takes usually about an hour and a half before we're ready to actually leave and drive to the spot.
Are you able to develop the same kinds of relationship with purveyors that restaurants do because you're working on such a small scale?
Yes, but yes.
Okay.
I'm going to say yes.
So because you're still buying an awful lot of carrots and...
Yeah, we buy in wholesale, and we personally try to partner with local farms to the best of our ability. The problem with that is that, let's say you have a really busy day and you run out, you need something quickly to be delivered to the truck, you're going to wind up working with a distributor that's closest in proximity. But for the most part, we try to partner with local New York-based farms.
And Jim,
mm-hmm.
How early do you start?
Well, we usually do all our prepping and all our groceries and all that kind of stuff the day before. So we start by getting everything on the truck around 7, 7:30. We're usually in our space by 9, 9:30, 10, latest.
Even though people don't eat Philly steaks until
Well, early bird catches the worm. You know, we could lose our space if we're not there. So,
so you just have to sit there and wait until lunchtime.
Yeah.
Do you ever sell stuff at 9:30, 10 o'clock?
No, we don't even open the window till about 11. And then we'll usually do lunch from 11 to about 2:45, 3. And then we'll head over to Union Square and start trying to scope out our space there and open them for about 4 to 9.
I think these are all great stories, and this is one of the misconceptions of food trucks. People just see smiles and long lines, and they think it's an easy business. But these entrepreneurs are getting up really early. It's a long day as a peddler to make it successful.
Heidi in Manhattan asks, do the same rules apply to food carts as for food trucks?
Many of them.
Yes.
Many of the laws do overlap. There are specific differences in where food carts are allowed to be on the sidewalk. There's a whole matrix that you need to sort of work through in terms of 10 feet from this, 20 feet from this, sidewalks need to be this certain depth. I'm not as savvy with those because we really focus on food trucks and the rules pertaining to food trucks and parking.
The last time you were here, David, you were joined by Kim Emo, who owns the Treats Truck, and she's recently opened a storefront in Carroll Gardens. But is that transition typical?
I think it's one of the really exciting things about food trucks is their ability to serve as a hospitality incubator, a way for less capital to start, get going, develop a brand, hone your operations, and then from that build a brick-and-mortar business that's a more stable part of the community. We've had more than 10 food trucks here in New York City go from a food truck to build a brick-and-mortar, including the Bistro Truck, Cupcake Stop, the Dessert Truck, the Kimchi Taco Truck, Mexico, Schnitzel and Things, Souvlaki GR, the Van Leeuwen Ice Cream Truck, and the Treats Truck. This is one of the things that we really want to convey to the city. This is a great way to incubate new businesses.
Some cultures actually have street food cultures, Mexico being one of them, and maybe that's why the Mexican food trucks have been so successful. It's really just transferring something that you would find in any major Mexican city.
Absolutely. A lot of the food trucks that tend to do best were historically a street food, and tacos are great street food because they're already packed up. They're ready to go. You can hold it in your hand, eat it on the go. That's also in part what really drives, the food truck growth in L.A. There's so many taco trucks.
So, Jim, are you going to try to open up a Phil Steaks restaurant?
I think so. I mean, we've been talking about what our next step could be. Originally we wanted to do a second truck first. Frankly, with all the regulations and everything, we're really second-guessing that. But we'd like to. I mean, I think in a lot of ways a truck is like the greatest branding tool you can have. It is out there. It's selling food. And it's a billboard that's out. Thousands of people are seeing it every hour.
And, Deborah, you're not going to open a shop. Are you getting into the juice business? Is that it?
Yep. I'm looking more towards creating a really savvy delivery system that I can be providing my juices to markets and catering for businesses.
And what about a dumpling restaurant?
Oh, we have two. We have two dumpling restaurants and a kiosk in Times Square. And in my book, the Food Truck Handbook, the last section of the book is really devoted to growing. And these are the outlets that we're looking at, is wholesaling or brick-and-mortar retail establishments.
David Weber is the co-owner of Rickshaw Dumplings, founder and president of the New York Food Truck Association, and the author of the book he just referred to, the Food Truck Handbook, Start, Grow, and Succeed in the Mobile Food Business. It's published by Wiley. Deborah Smith is at Green Pirate, a food truck that specializes in juices and health food, at least for the time being. Jim Drew is co-owner of Phil Steaks, an authentic cheesesteak truck. You find it at Union Square.
Yep.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Appreciate it.